Most sports fans fantasize suiting up for a professional team and running out onto the field in front of thousands of cheering fans, but only a few, like Stefan Fatsis, get the chance. In the summer of 2006, he participated in the Denver Broncos training camp as a place kicker, joining George Plimpton in the pantheon of embedded sports writers. He has chronicled his experiences in a book called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. It's published by Penguin, and I'm pleased that it brings Stefan Fatsis back to the show. Hi.
Hello.
And the last time you were here was to talk about playing Scrabble at a high level. That was a much less dangerous than this.
Well, dangerous maybe physically, but intellectually it was far more dangerous, I think.
Did you find a lot of the football players play Scrabble?
Oddly enough, I get to my locker on my first day. I'm dropped into this oasis, my locker. I'm dropped into this ocean, rather, of 6 foot five, 300-pound guys. And the guy to my right looks at me and says, "I know who you are. I play Scrabble all the time. I play with my family. I've read your book. I play online." So, no, there was a connection.
And were they did they play at a high level? After all, most of these guys are college graduates.
They are. Now, this guy was very good. He was a good living room player, as we said. And we wound up actually playing Scrabble between practices to sort of cut the monotony of training camp.
Was this project inspired by George Plimpton and Paper Tiger?
Paper Lion, yes.
Paper Lion. That's right. I put him on the wrong team.
I think any sports writer who grew up with a knowledge of Plimpton or reading Plimpton is indebted to Plimpton in many ways. And of course, when I had the idea to do this, my thought was it is time to do a modern version of Paper Lion.
Well, the sport has changed an awful lot since Paper Lion, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, he did this in 1963. At the time, the NFL was still a relatively small operation. It had just signed its first national TV contract. It had just formed a licensing and marketing division. It was just 5 years removed from the great game of 1958, the Colts against the Giants. The footprint was small, too. It was barely just extending west of the Mississippi.
And he joined the Lions as a quarterback.
Right.
He had no skills. You actually had some skills.
I tried. I had played soccer, so I knew that I could kick a ball. Kicking a football, I learned quickly, is a very, very different action than kicking a soccer ball. But it was something that I felt that I could credibly do. I didn't just want to do the Walter Mitty, what's it like for an average guy to stroll in off the street. I actually wanted to see whether someone in his 40s who had never been an athlete beyond high school could actually try, you know, how close could you get to becoming a competent athlete?
So I'm sure you practiced.
I did.
Now, for a long time, footballs were kicked. Place kickers kicked the balls head on. Mm-hmm. But then came the soccer style approach, which obviously you were using.
Sure.
And that, and at the beginning, there was a certain amount of resistance. You tell the story that I remember from way back when, Alex Karras making fun of Garo Yupremian.
Yes, Yupremian had never seen a football game when he signed to kick for the Detroit Lions. This is in 1966. And the first game, he kicked 5 field goals in his first game, never played a game of football before. But the first time he kicked an extra point, he went running off the field screaming, "I kick a touchdown!" And Karras yelled at him in Greek, actually. He yelled at him in Greek, "What are you doing?"
He should have been pleased. The guy was scoring for his team.
Exactly.
But there was a certain amount of snobbery there. What happened when you show up? You're not a typical football player today. Now the kickers are a lot bigger than they were when Garo Yupremian played.
They are. There's less snobbery these days than I think jealousy, because the kickers don't have to work as hard as the other position players do in practice. I mean, their lives, it's grueling. Training camp is absolutely grueling. For the kickers, you know, we spend a lot of time talking. We stand around. We practice drops. The punters walk up and down the field dropping the ball. You work on technique. So it's a running joke that the kickers have the life. But ultimately, the rest of the team recognizes that the kicker is very, very, very important.
But they're not really integrated into the rest of the team.
They actually are. On the Denver Broncos, Jason Elam, the kicker, was one of the most respected players there. He was the longest tenured player on the team.
Do kickers live up to their reputation as eccentric head cases?
I would say no, but I'm one of them. So they're a little bit different just because the job that they do requires them to be much more inwardly focused than I think the rest of the team, where there are so many moving parts and you're relying on your teammates more.
Well, because the other players are playing much of the game, the kicker is on the sidelines. And then when the kicking situation arises, he does a couple of practice kicks into a net and the game might turn on whether he kicks the ball accurately.
Yeah, I mean it's a fascinating paradox, and one that I think that a lot of sort of larger sports world football fans do resent, because as the game has become more sophisticated, as the athletes have gotten better, the role of the kicker, this outsider, has continued to increase.
Did you get a chance to kick during a game?
Not during a real game, and it's sort of similar to what happened to George Plimpton back in 1963. I mean, he details in Paper Lion. The NFL wouldn't let him into a real game, so he played quarterback in an intra-squad scrimmage. The same thing happened to me. I petitioned the NFL several times over the course of the summer, but they wouldn't budge, arguing that the integrity of the game was at stake, which I disagreed with.
Well, how did you do? You kicked during a full team practice.
I did. I absolutely did. And the title of the book, A Few Seconds of Panic, certainly relates to my experience. I never felt that under so much pressure. And in my mind, this was a game. I wanted to validate my presence on this team. I wanted to prove to my teammates that I belonged there. And I think every player feels that on some level. My job wasn't on the line, but my pride was, and my reason for being there was.
Well, to some degree, you were like an embedded reporter in Iraq, weren't you? I mean, you were both part of the group and an outsider, and you were taking notes, which made you different. And they must have been aware of the fact that you were writing things down.
You know, I was all the time, and they were aware of it, but there came a point where I think they forgot. And the difference I would draw, not to compare playing football to going to Iraq, but the difference that I would draw is that I was out there every day trying. I was lifting weights. I was taking care of my body. They made fun of me when I would go into the ice pool to try to revive my aging legs, or whether when I would wrap my legs in ACE bandages. But I participated in everything that they participated in. I was just smaller, shorter, older, and weaker.
My guest is Stefan Fatsis, F-A-T-S-I-S. His book, A Few Seconds of Panic, is published by Penguin. But you got to really look closely at these players. What's the psychological profile of the average NFL player? Are there some common threads, whether they're offensive or defensive players?
I think the common thread to me was that they are all extremely thoughtful people who aren't just playing football as a matter of chance. I mean, it's clearly something that they've spent their whole lives, and in many cases since they were 8 years old, preparing for this moment to get to the NFL. But I found a much greater degree of introspection, of thoughtfulness about the NFL, about the business of the NFL, about how it treats them as people.
And they talked about that?
Absolutely. They opened up to me. And I think I got them to open up to me, I think, because I was there. That they came to trust me as a teammate, not a reporter.
You call the rhythms of training camp bipolar or manic depressive. You occasionally use the metaphor of addiction. Is playing football really that mentally unhealthy?
I think it is, and I don't think the players would argue that it is. It is a taxing, in many ways stultifying environment. They get there at 7 in the morning. They leave at 10 at night during training camp. They are constantly being told that that every step is being monitored. We're going to watch you on film. We have cuts to make. Only the strongest will survive.
And some of the journeyman players you met seem to live in constant fear of being cut. So what motivates them to keep on playing? Is it really just love of the game?
Oddly enough, I think it is. I mean, it's hard to minimize the lure of the money. But the money only comes really if you make it in the league for longer than the average 3 years. The big money doesn't follow for a while. It's a small minority of players that reap those multimillion-dollar contracts that we tend to focus on. Most of the players that I encountered, and it was more than 100, came through Denver Broncos training camp that summer. Most of these guys are just hoping for one shot. They're hoping that their number gets called, that they win the lottery.
And they have to endure not just the anxieties we're talking about, but a lot of physical pain.
Constant pain. I mean, one player said to me, you're always hurt. You just don't talk about it. And if it's something that you can play through or just ignore, you'd prefer to do that because for two reasons. One, you don't want to come in at 6 in the morning to get treatment, which is what's required of seriously injured players. But more important, you don't want the coaches to perceive you as being injured. It's easier, I write in the book, to overcome the coach's to overcome an injury than it is the coach's perception that you're hurt.
So players will play through the pain, and
yes.
sometimes putting their physical health in danger.
Yeah,
because you might have a, you know, you might have a serious injury, and you're making believe you don't.
And that's the bargain that I think athletes make, particularly in the NFL, where the threshold for injury is so high. It's accepted among the players. One player said to me quite eloquently, "If I had to think about the pain and the potential for future injury, I couldn't go on every day." So they make this bargain that I will accept the short-term suffering and the potential long-term harm. In exchange for the pleasure I get from playing on Sundays and possibly the financial remuneration.
Does that mean gobbling a lot of painkillers?
In some cases, it does. I mean, I used to see players walk into back into the trainer's room and come back out with their preferred painkiller. Their doctors there prescribing them. They need them.
Do people get hurt a lot in training camp?
They do. I spent one day in camp, and I have described this in the book, where I just sort of watched the trainer all morning. And, you know, I watched one player walk behind. There was a yellow rope that would demarcate where the players could stand and where the action would take place. And he would walk by behind the rope, bent over, and just vomited a stream of water. He was completely dehydrated. Someone poured water on his back. He trotted back on the field. That same day, there was an offensive lineman named Cooper Carlisle came off wincing in pain. His shoulder was clearly injured. And the trainer came over, you know, examined him, and Cooper said, "Is this going to be, you know, it's going to hurt 10 minutes or 10 days? And the trainer looked at him and said, 10 minutes. And Cooper said, "When I do this, when I lift my arm, it hurts." And the trainer said, "Well, don't do it."
And that could be career-ending, can't it? I mean, there are players who played with concussions who
sure.
then ruined their lives.
Absolutely, it's a common occurrence.
So, did you ever take a hit?
I did not take a hit. I had friends that said to me, "You got to just take a hit to see what it feels like." And I kind of think I understand what it feels like. It would have hurt quite a lot and possibly have been, you know, serious and fatal maybe.
Because you're a little guy and those guys are big and they, even if they're trying to hold back a little bit, they are huge.
They are huge and you know, and they don't abuse it. They knew that at any moment they could have lifted me up and dumped me upside down in a garbage can. There was one day I was running across the field and one of the tight ends, a friend of mine on the team named Nate Jackson, I was wired that day. NFL Films had come to shoot a feature about my Plimptonian summer, and they could see the microphone taped my jersey underneath my jersey. And he just looked at me, and he went, and he pushed me in the chest as hard as he could, and I sort of stumbled backwards.
Ultimately, did you feel good about your performance as a kicker?
You know, I answer that question two ways now. I was asked to call to kick in front of the team a couple of times, and I ultimately achieved what I had hoped, which was to make my teammates proud, to do what I was called upon to do. In practice, though, I felt like I got up to the point where I was kicking 40-yard field goals, and I'm still proud of that. Before I started this, I thought maybe I could get up to 50-yarders, which was my goal.
But 40 is pretty good if you kick it over in the correct place, right?
It is, and I did that. And when you stand on a football field and you stand 40 yards away from the goalpost, you realize just how far it is, and then you add in the factor of these giant guys standing in front of you, which was something I had never done before. And I'm proud that I was able to get the ball that far.
Talk about giant guys. We had Plaxico Burress on the show last week, and he is huge, and yet he's not considered a large player.
Right. Yeah, there's a photo of me in the book. I'm standing outside a huddle of wide receivers, and I'm absolutely dwarfed, and these guys aren't even the big guys on the team.
If you were as stressed as you were during practice, you ever wonder what it would be like to be kicking a decisive field goal in an important game?
Well, it's given me a tremendous amount of respect for everything that these players do, but what all athletes do. The ability to shut everything out and perform in that kind of a situation is remarkable. And I think that fans don't often appreciate just how difficult what athletes do. It's very easy for fans, you know, because it's an outlet for us. It's very easy to say, what a jerk, what a bum, how could he not make that? I could kick a field goal. The reality is most of us can't kick field goals.
But so many people have the fantasy. Why do you think that is?
Because football is a release. The players are sort of mystified by the obsession that fans and the media have toward what they do and the amount of tears that are shed and the angry columns and opinions that are written in newspapers.
Well, baseball players have told me often that the game they play is totally different from the game that the fans watch.
Yeah.
That's true for football players as well?
I think even to an even greater degree. I think it's easier for fans to understand how a baseball game is played. Much more is visible to the naked eye. In football, there are so many interconnected parts and so much is going on at every given second. A player on the Broncos said to me, and I have a scene in the book where I sit down and talk to two of the cornerbacks, and he said, even the guys on TV, even the former NFL players, they don't know. If you don't know what my assignment was, if you don't know what my teammates were supposed to do, if you don't know what the offense's play call was, what the breakdown was, you can't possibly criticize
me. You don't know whether the offensive lineman was supposed to draw the defensive player in or to stop him. There's no way to know.
And it's as simple as someone having taken one step to one side or another.
So how did it feel watching the Broncos play their first real game that season after you'd left the team?
I missed it. I felt like I had been cut. I felt like I should have been down there because I did get to dress for preseason games. I was on the field. I kicked in warmups. I ran out with the team through the tunnel in Invesco Field in Denver. I got to witness what it's like on a sideline, and I did feel for these players. I mean, I did feel like a member of the team.
Did it give you any insight into why Brett Favre is considering unretiring?
Absolutely. There's a player I write about in the book named Adam Meadows, an offensive lineman, and he had been with the Colts for many seasons, a starter, very successful, had shoulder surgery, signed with a new team as a free agent, couldn't lift his arm to play, and retired, returned a $2.5 million bonus, which is unheard of in modern sports. And 2 years later, he comes to the Broncos to try to attempt a comeback. And I said, why? You've got a ton of money. You've got a happy family. You're successful outside of football. Why? And he said, I just missed it. I missed the guys. I missed the locker room. I missed the pressure, the camaraderie. I missed Sundays. You don't get that in real estate, he said.
The weirdest thing is they say I missed the hitting, which I would never miss. Stefan Fatsis will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street in Broadway, and he has two other events in early August. You can find out about them on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, A Few Seconds of Panic, is published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And on tomorrow's show, more football. Tony Dungy, the first African-American head coach to win the Super Bowl, will be with us. Also, a look at the use of eminent domain in New York City and the changing nature of public versus private space. Then John Sikaloff and David Brancaccio of PBS's Now on unlikely activists who have changed their communities all over America. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Lawrence Holland, Jen Poyant, and Veronica Shigiel. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.